This Civic Media podcast is sponsored by UW Organ and Tissue Donation. Organ donations are desperately needed, and now is the right time to become an organ donor. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. Go to heroicdeed.com.
This ain't Texas. Ooh. Ain't no hold'em. Hey. So lay your cards down, 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 down. So park your Lexus. Your keys up. Hey. Stick around, round, 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 round. And I'll be damned if I can't slow dance with you. Come pour some sugar on me, honey, too. It's a real live boogie and a real live hold down. Don't be a bitch, come take it to the floor now. Woo. There's a tornado.
Hey everybody, I'm Maggie Dawn, and you're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show right here on the Civic Media Radio Network, where we're all about real news and great conversation. And as soon as Donald Trump takes office, there's going to be a lot of real news we'll have you covered here. My very special next guest is Bobby Cogan. He is the Senior Director of Federal Budget Policy at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. He served in the Biden-Harris White House as advisor to the Director of the Office of Management and Budget. And before the Biden-Harris administration, he was a policy advisor and budget coordinator for the transition team, and he's also served on the Democratic staff of the U.S. Senate Committee on the Budget as the chief mathematician and head of budget analysis, budget concepts, and budget scorekeeping. So, yeah, he can't do any math at all. Real dim bulb, Bobby. Thanks so much for sharing your expertise with us this bright Monday. Let's just dig right in. What is the reconciliation process you supposed to be like back in the old days, and what can we expect in this go round that might be different?
Sure, Maggie, thanks so much for having me on. So reconciliation used to be used as a mega bipartisan deficit reduction tool. Since the 90s, it has shifted and is now used exclusively as a partisan process to avoid the filibuster. So normally in the Senate, it takes 60 votes to do anything. It's hard to get 60 senators to agree to stuff. If you follow the specific rules of budget reconciliation, of which there are many, then you can do it with only 50 votes plus the VP. So, with a simple majority instead of 60 votes. And so in today's day and age, it will, we should see it as a tool for Donald Trump to be able to enact some of his agenda, make some of it incredibly real.
And so what do you think are sort of in the top three or top five things that we can very reasonably expect to see in the reconciliation process? And then secondly, Bobby, why is the reconciliation process a bad, other than the filibuster, right? The voting threshold, which is itself a process issue, right? But why is the reconciliation process itself not a great place to be forging new policy?
Sure. So I'll take the second one first and then go to the first question. The reconciliation, because of all of its limitations, the normal things that you would want to do when you're writing legislation to try to make sure the money is going to be directed in the right sort of way to make sure that it's going to do what you want, a lot of those things cannot make it through the limitations of reconciliation. So as a result, instead of being kind of a surgical endeavor, it ends up being a blunt hammer. So it's fine, right? You can do a lot of major stuff, but if Congress were working right, then you wouldn't rely on reconciliation. And actually in the past, when they would do stuff in a major bipartisan way, they would just ignore the rules of reconciliation all the time anyway. But nowadays it is just this very narrow thing. So what can we see? We are definitely going to see Trump tax cuts 2.0. Trump tax cuts 1.0 were done through reconciliation. 2.0 will also be done through reconciliation. We will almost definitely see border, defense, climate, right? So they have signaled desire to increase defense spending, to increase money at the border, wall, deportation squad, kind of detention facilities. Other stuff, asterisk, that's where you start getting into some of the rules of what you probably can't do. And then energy, TBD on what that means. It could be something like more leasing of oil the United States government owns, but it could be something like repealing the green energy investments from the IRA, which would end up like raising energy prices on a lot of consumers and also on small businesses. And so that's where we're going to have to see. And then there's the other stuff that they have been floating. Just the other day, House Budget Committee Chair Arrington put out his kind of like wish list, and it included like $2.5 trillion of healthcare cuts, Medicaid and ACA cuts, you know, eviscerating SNAP and TANF and childcare stuff. So that's, you know, that's where we have to see if they have the votes. I mean, this stuff is incredibly real, but it's, you know, it's where their narrow margins start to really matter.
So will there be one big reconciliation bill, or will this comes in drips and drabs and we've got to track a bunch of different things? From an attention perspective, how do people keep their eye on this? Because holy cow, let's just see what you ticked up. Energy and environment, right? Childcare, kids' meals, climate, defense, the border, and of course, the thing that'll probably cost the middle class the most in the end, the Trump tax cuts for billionaires and the biggest, most wealthy corporations. How do we keep our eye on all this? How's it going to move?
Yeah, so the Republicans still have to figure out what they want to do. They don't know what they want to do because their factions can't agree. I think even though they have a slim majority, there's lots of disagreement. As you mentioned, the Trump tax cuts are incredibly expensive, right? Like we're talking $4 trillion. So some of them are uncomfortable with how large that is. So then some of them say, okay, well, we want to do a lot of cuts then so that we're not increasing the deficit and debt so much. But then some of the cuts they're asking for are really nasty. I mean, they're really brutal. They would kick millions of people off their health insurance. They would, you know, severely increase food insecurity and number of unhoused people, right? So all of a sudden, if you put that in, you might lose a couple votes. If you lose a couple votes, the whole thing might fall apart. So then they say, well, let's put in this, you know, whatever, right? And so all of a sudden it becomes difficult. It could all be done in one bill. It could be done in multiple bills. Majority Leader Thune in the Senate supported a two bill, maybe third bill approach. In the House, they really want to do one. The president-elect suggested that he supported one, but then he kind of immediately walked it back and said, oh, well, you know, whatever Congress can agree on. I think it's TBD. We'll just have to see, you know, are they going to take the easy stuff first and then leave the harder stuff till later? Are they going to try to, you know, kind of grease the wheels with the easy stuff? We'll just have to see. In BBB, which like kind of famously failed, right? When we tried to do that in the Biden administration, we ended up with the IRA, which still did a lot of good, right? It was the biggest clean energy investment in US history. And it was paid for by making prescription drug prices lower, taxing corporations. Like it was still great, but the original bill would have done so much more. It would have transformed us into a much, you know, bigger, better social democracy with childcare and pre-K and that sort of stuff. And it fell apart because there were so many things to track. People didn't know what to do. They just heard tough stuff. It was hard to message. Republicans are going to run into kind of the same issue.
It's fascinating to me that very issue, how slim the majorities are, right? It's like, oh yes, Donald Trump controls all three branches of government. Well, when you look at the legislature a little bit more closely, it is razor thin, and trying to keep those coalitions together is certainly going to be really difficult. Why does a party want to use the reconciliation? Is it merely to avoid the filibuster? Is that the why behind this? Because it has all these restrictions on the what's and very specific procedural rules as well. It's just about the filibuster.
Yeah, that's right. It is literally just about the filibuster. Now, I'll just say for some pieces of legislation, you can do most of what you want. This you should think about reconciliation as being about getting federal dollars and cents in or out of the government. That's what it's for. And so every provision needs to be kind of, that needs to be its primary and kind of full purpose or a term and condition necessary to make it happen. So if you're doing a tax bill, that's great. That's easy. That's taxes are about dollars and cents. When you want to do spending, well, the primary aspect of the spending is about dollars and cents, but some of the conditions you want to do might not be about that. So tax bills, Republicans can basically do anything they want. And similarly, when we were raising taxes through reconciliation on corporations, that was no problem. It's just when they start to kind of do a lot more policy that they run into issues. And so, as you say, it is just a product of getting around reconciliation, the filibuster. It is not a good tool. It is just the tool that they have. And, you know, there are pluses and minuses with that. When we did the Inflation Reduction Act, we weren't able to kind of direct some of the money the way that we would have preferred to do. And that's just the limitation of our broken Congress. And I would just say, you know, if Republicans wanted to, they could search for a bipartisan deal on this, but they don't want to do it that way. They want to do it the way they want, which is their prerogative, but that means the limitations.
The other thing that occurs to me is, even if you're talking about maybe two or three, but certainly Donald Trump's initial salvo being one big reconciliation bill, I'm gonna say this with as much respect as I can possibly muster. Maybe it's just going to be dripping with sarcasm. I put the odds at, especially members on the House side, having a full and complete understanding of the ramifications of what are massive budget and fiscal policy decisions and reconciliation bills at zero. I mean, especially if you're doing the big omnibus sort of reconciliation approach, there's simply not enough bandwidth in most House members' offices to really understand, again, for that particular constituency, like, wait a minute, what are all of the long-term impacts? And I'm going to make a statement and then ask you to correct where I'm wrong and your views on this, Bobby. And that is, if that's true, right, if they're really not getting their arms around all of this detail and substance, then isn't this at a certain level, especially in the House, about hammering talking points and about following dear leader a wee bit?
You are certainly right that there's no way, if they move at the speed they moved last year, they will know what they're doing. When they passed their tax cut bill, they had changed it so many times. I think the day before they did $500 billion worth of gross changes. There was no distributional analysis on who it would affect, how much, what the long-term impact.
I'm going to jump in and just emphasize what you said. The first Donald Trump tax cuts reconciliation, they did not know with their last adjustments to that package, the distributional impact, which is smart guy way of saying, hey, who's actually getting the lion's share of benefit here? The really, 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 really rich people or the middle class? They didn't know the answer to that. We're going to come back. We're going to talk a little bit more about not knowing how it impacts people distributionally, meaning whether it helps the middle class actually, or really just creates a windfall benefit to the rich. More with Bobby Cogan. He is the Senior Director for Federal Budget Policy at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Sorry I had to hop in there, but that was a big one, Bobby. And we got to take care of a little business of our own here, folks. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. We're talking about an unsexy thing, reconciliation, that will have big, big impact.
You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. We sell crack to our own out the back of our homes. We smell the musk of the dusk and the crack of the dawn. We go through episodes too, like Attack of the Clones. Watch till we break a bag and you'll hear the crack of the bone. To get by, just to get by, just to get by, just to
many of us are just trying to get by. And the promised reconciliation bill from the GOP led by Donald Trump will make it harder for most Wisconsinites. Here to discuss why is Bobby Cogan. He is the Senior Director of Federal Budget Policy at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. I was just talking about, before we went to break with you, Bobby, was the fact that oftentimes it is very hard for members to actually understand the impacts of what these reconciliation bills will mean for their constituents, as well as not just their particular constituents, but amongst different groups, different ways to splice and dice our citizenry, meaning does it really help the wealthiest and the middle class not so much? Or how is this actually going to impact people? This is what I'm really concerned about, right? We've got, let's see here, 700,000 Wisconsinites rely on SNAP, meaning food stamps. Over 1 million rely on Medicaid. Republicans, these sorts of cuts, draconian cuts to these kinds of programs, are likely to be on the docket for this next either big reconciliation bill or reconciliation bills. Should Wisconsinites be able to expect each and every one of their members of Congress and their two senators to take the time to understand, as you put it in smart person speak, the distributional impacts of these reconciliation bills? In other words, who actually wins as a result of these massive changes?
Well, one of the senators, for sure. Maybe not the other one. I would just say, look, there's sometimes willful ignorance, right? So if you look at in 2017, Republicans tried to do two reconciliation bills. They tried to repeal the ACA, and then they did the Trump tax cuts. And when they were trying to repeal the ACA, the Congressional Budget Office, which is kind of the neutral arbiter, they kind of estimate the impact of legislation, not only the budgetary costs, but kind of how it affects people sometimes for these bills. And they came out and they said, this is going to kick millions of people off their health insurance. And the official GOP line was, no, it's not. And they've spent the last, you know, 7 or 8, I guess now almost 8 years saying, oh, well, CBO is just bad. That, you know, that's their response now, is that's just wrong, which is absurd, right? Because they were calling to cut $1 trillion of federal health care assistance for buying health insurance. Now, they might not like that the federal government's involved, but you can't tell me with a straight face that if you spend $1 trillion less, it's not going to mean some people don't have health insurance anymore. That's obviously true. And their response was, nuh-uh. Same thing with the Trump tax cuts, right? They said, look, you know, the point of tax cuts is to cut taxes. That lowers revenue, that increases the deficit. You might like that, but that's what it does. And their response was, nah, right? And their official line now is that somehow it, you know, magically more than paid for itself.
Yeah, it's the magic box in which tax cuts go in, but somehow increased deficits don't come out. I've yet to understand how the math's on all of that. But, you know, here's the thing. Every single one of us in the state of Wisconsin deserves to know that our elected officials have taken the time to consider whether or not the promise of helping the middle class, which was the entire platform of Donald Trump, right? If that is actually the anticipated impact from the reconciliation bill or bills. The CBO is the nonpartisan nerd rich office that is responsible for that analysis. Can we actually demand that our elected officials at least acknowledge the CBO analyses? Will we know if we actually will get CBO analyses before the bills? So when is all of this happening, and what should we be doing to hold our congresspeople and our senators here in the state of Wisconsin accountable?
Yeah, so last time they moved too quickly for analysis, and that was the issue. They didn't want the analysis, and when stuff kind of dribbled out, they just said, no, not true. So I worry, right? So like in that Jody Arrington, in the Chairman Arrington piece that I alluded to, they called for cutting SNAP by over a quarter, right? Like that's, you know, for the folks who rely on food stamps in Wisconsin, like, you know, we need to know like the actual impact, how many people, how much less in benefit, right? And that's the sort of thing you get if you're not moving at breakneck speed, but you might deliberately try to hide if you are doing that. Same thing for Medicaid, right? They called for $2.4 trillion in Medicaid cuts. A lot of people rely on Medicaid, right? I mean, it's one of the most, you know, kind of foundational pillars of society that we take care of people who are struggling. And they were one vote away last time from permanently destroying Medicaid, from turning it from kind of a grow with need into a block grant that would grow not with need, just based on kind of CPIM plus one. And, you know, we'll see what happens. The only thing I can say is that, you know, for the folks listening, you should be paying attention and you should be talking to your representatives. We did beat the ACA repeal last time. We didn't think we would, but we really did. And it's always uphill because they technically have the majority and they can technically do it with a simple majority. But the more that they start doing stuff that is actually going to harm the American people, some folks will get really spooked, and that's where your voice can be heard. It was folks calling in and attending the town halls and everything that really made the difference last time. Folks saying, please, I rely on this and I can't afford if it goes away. That was what made the difference last time.
Everyone, that is Bobby Kogan. He's the Senior Director for Federal Budget Policy at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Follow him. He is going to be posting about this as the reconciliation process gets underway. You can follow him on Blue Sky and Twitter, that other thing, Blue Sky, at BB Kogan. That's BBKOGAN. Bobby, will you please come back when these first bills start moving? And we will talk about these impacts. And of course, everyone, I will drop the email address and phone numbers, DC and their local district offices, for every single elected member of Congress and the Senate in the state of Wisconsin when this starts to happen, because we demand to know if their campaign promises to actually help the middle class are reflected in what gets introduced in the new Trump administration, because I don't think so, y'all. Thank you so much, Bobby. I really appreciate it. Again, we've got 1 million Wisconsinites on Medicaid, 700 Wisconsinites on SNAP. All of that may be left on the cutting room floor to some degree, depending on what the budget reconciliation process shows. Happy New Year, Bobby. It's great to have you. Please do come back. Let me know if you've got some time that week, because we got to keep people up to date on all of this. Everybody, I'm Maggie Dawn. When we come back, I'll be joined by my little buddy and yours, Dom Salvia, joins me for In Case You Missed It with Dom Salvia. We'll dig in more to the North Carolina voting cases, as well as those Jack Smith reports, and will they ever see the light of day? Keep it locked right here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're an organ donor, right? Well, here's a tragic fact. Approximately 20 people die each day waiting for precious donated organs. You could make a life-saving decision simply by getting that important dot on your driver's license. That little dot shows those who need to know that you've made a decision to donate organs at a critical time. Go to heroicdeed.com to learn more about the importance of organ donation and how you can make your wishes known. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. HeroicDeed.com.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm going to try to smoothly seduce my little buddy with some fabulous logic and legal analysis. It is In Case You Missed It with Dom Salvia. Dom joins me every Monday at 3:30 to talk about the week in the news. It's so good to be with you, my friend. Just a couple of two tree things going on.
Yeah, a few things. Good to be with you, Maggie. Thanks for having me.
I gotta also say to you, I will be rooting for the Lions
yes.
moving forward, and enough said about that.
tough game yesterday, no doubt, but go Lions.
Yeah, began the season with a bang and going out in a whimper-ish. The Lions. Dom, spent the first hour with all of you wonderful people talking about this quagmire that is occurring in North Carolina. We need not revisit, but the place that I got with everyone is simply this. If a technical element of election law that requires, say, inclusion of a social security number, your city and zip code on your absentee ballot, whatever it may be, and there's technical variations from state to state, If such a technical requirement, if the failure to meet that requirement is going to result in tossing out a ballot, two things should be true. The law either has to say that explicitly, or you have to sue to make that clear at least 90 to 120 days before the election.
Right.
You don't get to wait until everybody's cast their ballots and then be like, oh, well, these people, maybe in Milwaukee and Dane counties. What's the partisan lean in Milwaukee and Dane counties? We'll just challenge the ballots that... That's not how this is supposed to work. And I don't understand why we all wouldn't say, well, of course so. Yep. Make the rules clear ahead of time.
Make the rules clear ahead of time. Follow them. If there's going to be any changes, give ample notice, as mentioned, 120 days. Do not try to change them after the fact, after the votes have been counted. Yeah, that seems very practical and logical to me. And when it comes down to whether or not people should have their votes counted, I would err on the side of, yes, people should have their votes counted.
Little buddy, you're a genius, because guess what it says at the preamble of nearly every state's bulk of state statutes about voting and elections? It says, where there are questions, as long as the voter's intent is clear, you count the vote.
Right.
Because what? This is such a fundamental right. I just don't understand why this isn't the presumption. All of the rest, all of the sort of smoke and mirrors around this is garbage. I've also argued, listen, Dems should stop pushing back on voter ID. It was racist, right? It was voter suppression, all that stuff, but it is now baked into the cake. Voters overwhelmingly in polling like the idea of voter ID. But get this, of course, little buddy, it's not about ID anymore. Now they want to add on, oh, you got to prove your citizenship. Oh, we got to do this extra thing and an extra thing and extra thing. It will always be constant movement of the goalposts. And until we say, if something is going to trigger throwing out a ballot, the law has to say so. And if it doesn't, it won't. Period. Yep. Why is it not this simple?
The voter ID thing. My sense on this is, yes, it was racist. It was, and we didn't, you know, expand the ability for folks to get their ID.
We made it harder. Closed down a bunch of those DMVs, right, said Scott Walker.
Exactly opposite of what the states did that implemented voter ID that the judge used to justify their position, who apparently, you know, felt some remorse on that decision, given how Wisconsin had closed down the DMVs for folks to get their ID. But at the end of the day, Meg, you know, how do we do these elections 100 years ago? We didn't have a photo ID back then. Was everything fraudulent then? You don't know. Of course not. And what are we going to do 100 years from now? We're going to be relying on a
retinal scans.
This is what I'm saying. So we're going to bake something into the Constitution that will ultimately, as you mentioned, there's going to be continued pressures and movement for what I would say voter suppression, because there is not in-person voter ballot fraud happening to any degree that would make any of this matter. It's really about squashing the people's ability to come out and vote, and the Republicans are fine with martyring their own so long as they get a little bit of the Dems more.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, just the MAGAs have gone on the record over and over and over again. Like, the fewer people that vote, the better for us. That's right. What it's all about. Yep. And especially fewer of those black and brown folks, mm-hmm. and then women folks, and them LGBTQ folks, and
those
student
college
folks.
Kids. Yeah, don't
and,
make
yeah,
it
them
too
student
easy.
Folks, and them elderly folks, and those folks with disability. Yeah, fewer of all of them. No kidding, really. I mean, let's get beyond this. If you're going to throw the ballot out, it has to be clear beforehand that that is the remedy for technical violation 852 sub 5 sub 6, right? I mean, stop it. This is so anti-democratic. It is absurd. Having resolved that issue definitively, let's move on to the Mideast peace process, Tom. Just kidding. What I wanted to talk with you about and get your reaction, because there was a bit of history made on Friday, little buddy. So did you listen to the whole sentencing hearing?
I did not. I got bits and pieces of it, read the reporting, did not listen to the entirety.
Dribs, of course, I did in its entirety. This nerd did. And I wanted to get some of your reactions to some of the pieces that I thought were just most extraordinary. And here's one that I don't think has gotten nearly enough press. And literally, Cardi, this is going to be cut number one. This is Donald Trump's defense lawyer, Todd Blanche. Listen to the sincerity with which this statement is made, without one little drip of irony seeming to occur to Mr. Blanche. Take a listen.
It's a very sad day. It's a sad day for President Trump and his family and friends, but it's also, in counsel's view, a sad day for this country, because this was a case, without a doubt, that was brought by a district attorney who promised that he would go after President Trump if elected and felt like he had to go through with that promise. And so that's sad. And I hope, and I know that President Trump shares this view, that this will never happen again in this country.
Hey, Todd, did you just say that someone ran on a promise of prosecuting their political enemies, fulfilled that promise, and that's a bad thing that should never happen again in this country?
It sounds like what he said isn't exactly what Donald Trump has been insinuating that he would do once he returns to office.
The straight-faced sincerity of that was just... And there wasn't one snicker. I wouldn't have been able to hold it together. Like, I'm sorry, Judge. Did I hear that correctly there? Right? What? Absolutely bananas. All right, then this one, which is pretty funny. There's two different versions of this statement, which during Donald Trump's soliloquy, he said this probably five or six times. I picked the two I found most humorous. Cardi, if you can just roll 2A and then roll right into 2B.
Legal fees or legal expense were put down as legal expense by accountants. They weren't put down by me. They were put down by accountants. I didn't call them construction, concrete work. I didn't call them electrical work. I didn't call them any. They called a legal fee or a legal expense, and for this, I got indicted. It's incredible, actually. In our country today, with a city that's burning to the ground, one of our largest, most important cities burning to the ground, with wars that are uncontrollably going on, with all of the problems of inflation and attacks on countries and all of the horrible things that are going on, I got indicted over calling a legal expense. It was called a legal expense.
Yeah, because you don't write payoff to porn star.
Oh, and I have to reiterate. It wasn't the payoff to the porn star or the classification. What was the big problem here? This was an effort, his first effort, an election interference. He paid the hush money. Why did he pay the hush money? He didn't want the story of the sex with the porn star to come out on the tail end of the 2016 election. So it wouldn't hurt him. That was the point of it. Well, nobody cares if he had sex, but when you do that, when you did that, that was election interference. And when you classify those expenses as such, that's fraud, man.
Yeah, it's you could write down payoff to porn star so that I can deceive the American public and illegitimately claim the White House. Like, that's not a legal expense.
I think
it's an illegal
expense. You have to create a new account number for that one. You gotta
what's the IRS accounting code for that? it's nuts. Now, I went through it. I wanted to just kind of high level for you the categories of Trump complaints about the case. Because later this week, I'm going to get into the details of a bunch of those. But basically, it's Alvin Bragg wouldn't prosecute it and somebody else decided to do so. So it's arguments about how a prosecutor exercised prosecutorial discretion about whether to charge and what to charge. That's category one. Category two is Judge Mershon is hopelessly conflicted. Before the case even got underway, Judge Mershon went to the New York State Judicial Ethics Board and was like, hey, can you provide an opinion on this? Should I recuse myself? No. He went back. Are you sure? No. No, really? Are you super, super sure? No. He did everything that he possibly could. That's category two. Basically, it's then I've been elected and I'm great, so none of this matters. And I got a gag order, and that was unfair. And then arguments over witness credibility. Like, that is the entirety of the Donald Trump retort machine on this one. And it's like, yep, prosecutors execute discretion all the time. You don't like prosecutorial discretion? You don't like the U.S. legal system, all of it, every last bit of it when it comes to criminal prosecutions in this country. Yep. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. That's a thing.
Yeah, especially when it's applied to me. Now, you want to prosecute other people for those crimes. Go knock yourself out. I am the law and order president from the law and order party. But yes, his grievances are shallow. And did they ever address, hey, Trump, your signature was on the checks, man. You were writing those checks from the Oval Office. His attorney, Michael Cohen, went to jail for his part in this
crime.
Well,
he's discredited for that. Is it the jail part or the conviction, Don? Because you now got a few of those convictions. Witness credibility. Yep. Guess what? Jury system in these United States, juries decide which witnesses they believe. We have lots of imperfect witnesses. Michael Cohen is an imperfect witness in the extreme. Guess who else would have been a terrible witness in his own defense? Donald J. Trump. Notice, you didn't even take the stand, friend.
No, he certainly
did not. No lawyer would
not.
Ever have you swear. You know, perjury is actually a problem.
Oh, don't worry about it. He's going to take another oath next week, Maggie, so it'll be fine.
Yeah, it's nothing to see here. But by far, the statement that I thought was most important in that entire sentencing hearing, this is cut six, Cardi, was this from Judge Mershon.
So while one can argue that the trial itself was in many respects somewhat ordinary, the same cannot be said about the circumstances surrounding this sentencing. And that is because of the office you once occupied and which you will soon occupy again. To be sure, it is the legal protections afforded to the office of the President of the United States that are extraordinary, not the occupant of the office. The legal protections, especially within the context of a criminal prosecution, afforded to the office of the President have been laid out by our founders, the Constitution, and most recently interpreted by the United States Supreme Court in the matter of Trump versus the United States, which was decided on July 1st, 2024.
The office, not the occupant. Folks, I'm joined this half hour by my little buddy and yours, Dom Salvia. We're getting Dom's takes on the Judge Mershon sentencing hearing, the historic moment when the first incoming president of the United States and the first former president of the United States was officially declared a convicted felon.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Never lonely. You're here with Dom Salvia and I. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to, in case you missed it, with Dom Salvia right here on the Maggie Dawn Show. Dom's got the great program that follows mine every Monday through Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. We're just giving a quick little review of the Donald Trump felony sentencing on a Friday. Mershon, his tone is about as flat as you can possibly get, but there were a couple points of emphasis a couple times that I thought were really interesting. I want to give you one last little bit of sound, Dom. Then I wanted to get your perspective on this, the only case that reached a jury, a verdict, a sentence, and a conviction. Cardi, let's take cut eight if we can.
To be clear, the protections afforded the office of the president are not a mitigating factor. They do not reduce the seriousness of the crime or justify its commission in any way. The protections are, however, a legal mandate, which pursuant to the rule of law, this court must respect and follow. However, despite the extraordinary breadth of those protections, one power they do not provide is the power to erase a jury verdict.
Guilty.
Yeah. My take is that Judge Mershon is probably going to go down as a judicial genius for two reasons. One is his ability to get through the circus and chaos, to insulate his every decision at every turn throughout that case by allowing arguments, by allowing Donald Trump to raise whatever appeals he wanted, permitting the appeals to, like, he let him have his say and make the arguments that he wished to argue. He followed the law. And here's the last bit of genius. When he announced early last week that he was, that there was going to be, in effect, an unconditional, like no penalty at all whatsoever, an unconditional release, what he did was remove any fig leaf of an excuse for the Supreme Court to intervene in Donald Trump's sentencing. Your thoughts on the historical importance of that sentencing this past Friday and on the manner in which Judge Mershon conducted this trial?
Well, thank you, Maggie. A couple of things. I think the professionalism that Mershon showed throughout this trial and show is unquestionable. I mean, the guy was straight up. I mean, he was getting threats from, and he'd take the threats. You know, he was getting threats from Trump, whatever, but you know, not family, not other court members and so forth, the jury, those kinds of things. So I think from an operational standpoint, he handled it perfectly. I mean, about as well as anybody could, I think. And I do appreciate the fact that he came with this unconditional discharge in order to make the conviction stick, right? Otherwise, it's going to be appealed. It's going to be appealed anyway, but perhaps this will make it stick. The verdict and the conviction, those will stay. Unfortunately, practically speaking, if you're a convicted felon and your sentence is zero, nothing, nada, it didn't happen. It doesn't matter. I could have $1 million in the bank, but if I don't have access to it, I can't get it, I don't have it. You know what I'm saying? It is a sentence without consequence. It is a conviction without consequence. Now, he can say, oh, he's a convicted felon, and he's the first convicted felon. I will certainly bring that up to my mega friends often. But the practical matter is he got away with it. So what if he's a felon? He's got an F on his chest. You know, so what? What does that mean? What does that mean for the justice system? Well, he maintains the conviction. He has been sentenced. He is a felon. Great. But anybody else would have been doing some time or at least some fines or some probation and wearing an ankle bracelet, something to discourage that kind of behavior going forward. Now, that is I think a function certainly more of our justice system in this case, as we deal with ex-presidents and now soon to be presidents, has anything to do with what Mershon did. I mean, he's got to deal with play with the cards that he was dealt, and he dealt them and he played them to make sure that this conviction that Donald Trump would be a convicted felon. So check mark for that. But with zero consequence, did Donald Trump learn a lesson? Did anybody else learn a lesson? Did any of the folks in New York who are currently being tried for this very same kind of crime, are they getting a break? You know, that doesn't seem right to me. So yes, good on the sentencing and conviction. You got that, but really an absolute disappointment. Again, it's not on the judge. I put this entire thing on the slow walking, in some cases, what, Cyrus Vance, right? That was named Cyrus. Yeah, the DA.
Cyrus Vance, yep. Mm-hmm.
Before Alvin Bragg came in, he could have done something before that. He slow walked it. And of course, the Attorney General Merrick Garland on the other thing, sitting on his hands for over a year. I mean, those folks, I think, in a large part, failed us in these court cases.
Well, yes, and by far the biggest betrayal of the most fundamental idea behind American democracy is we do not have the divine right of kings, and presidents aren't kings. This approach by Judge Mershon would never have happened but for the Supreme Court's immunity decision. He took great care to name check the decision with the date, lest there be any confusion over what was mandating his decision to basically have no penalty for Donald Trump. That is who bears responsibility. Yeah, right. Donald Trump and the hopelessly corrupted Supreme Court of the United States. Dom Salvia is up next with the Dom Salvia Show. I'll see you tomorrow, little buddy, for more. Folks, remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.